So I just want to start by saying welcome to everyone and welcome to those that are new. And if it's your first Sunday here, just want to say welcome too. Today we will be talking about Peter's denial in that second part of John chapter 18. But first, I just want to say a little bit about Christian testimonies. They truly are a beautiful thing. If you've ever had to give your testimony, you might have been told there's like a three-part format that you do. Basically, you talk about your life before Christ, how you came to know Christ, and then your life since you met Christ. Now, we all have different backgrounds, and that first part of our testimony is in some way unique to everyone. Even the last part is unique in a lot of ways, because once we become Christians, God uses us in different ways. But that second part, how God changed us, I think is really the same for all of us. Because what happens when we're changed is that message of the gospel, it breaks through. And we know that we're changed. And we know that it's not a work that we did, but it was a work done in us by God. Because at the end, we know deep down that we're not the same people that we were. But the question today is, what do we do when we fail? What do we do when we make mistakes? Here we'll read the story of Peter, and we'll see how he fails. But there's much we can learn from his story, how God can work in our lives in both good circumstances and sometimes in bad. And as Christians, how's Peter's life and all of our lives as Christians and our testimonies testify just to the transforming power of God's grace. So let's read his story. Now, Simon Peter was following Jesus, and so was another disciple. Now, that disciple was known to the high priest, and he entered with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. But Peter was standing at the door outside, so the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the doorkeeper and brought Peter in. Then the slave woman who was the doorkeeper said to Peter, "You are not also one of this man's disciples, are you?" He said, "I am not." Now the slaves and the officers were standing there, having made a charcoal fire, for it was cold, and they were warming themselves, and Peter was also with them, standing and warming himself. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. Jesus answered him, "I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple area, where all the Jews congregate, and I said nothing in secret. Why are you asking me? Ask those who have heard what I spoke to them. Look, these people know what I said." But when he said this, one of the officers who was standing nearby struck Jesus, saying, "Is that the way you answer the high priest?" Jesus answered him, "If I have spoken wrongly, testify of the wrong. But if rightly, why do you strike me?" So Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now Simon Peter was still standing and warming himself. So they said to him, "You are not one of his disciples as well, are you?" He denied it and said, "I am not." One of the slaves of the high priest, who was related to the one whose ear Peter cut off, said, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" Peter then denied it again, and immediately a rooster crowed. That's God's word. So I just want to start, before we get going with anything, I just want to start with a few questions. My first question is, how many selfies do you think are taken in a day? Now, just think about that for a second, and then we'll put the answer up on the screen. It turns out there's around 93 million taken in a day, which I thought, to be honest, it would be more. Now, what about social media posts? There's a lot of social media platforms, but let's pick Facebook. I'm old, and I remember a time when there was just Facebook. So how many stories do you think are posted on Facebook in a day? All right, so you got your answer in mind. It's over 1 billion stories. So I was thinking, this came to my mind because I was thinking about just how 2,000 years from now, if the cloud survives and there's enough data, people are going to know a lot about us, maybe too much sometimes. But when we go to talk about Peter and his life 2,000 years ago, there's not a lot sometimes that we know. So the thing is, as we read this story, Peter's kind of on trial in our mind. He failed Jesus, and it seems like it was an avoidable thing, that a lot of it came down to maybe his pride and his arrogance. But I sort of want to give Peter a fair trial, so to speak. And I want to do that, I want to show you a little bit of who Peter was and how, in a lot of ways, we're all similar to him. So let's talk a little bit about Peter's life. Now, I kind of have this, I don't study biblical archaeology much, but anytime I come across, I enjoy reading what I read. And I was nervous about putting this in the sermon because I didn't know if other people cared as much as I did, and I didn't want to bore people, but I thought this was really cool. So there's an archaeological site in northern Israel near the Sea of Galilee. And there, the archaeologists think they might have found Peter and his brother Andrew's original home and possibly their birthplace. You'll see in the picture the site there. There's also, they don't know for sure that it's his home, but they do know that it was a church in the second and third century. And there's an inscription there. Our second picture will show this. There's an inscription there in Greek. And the inscription reads, Chief and Commander of the Heavenly Apostles, which is something at that time that people referred to Peter as. So the point is, we don't know. There's some things about his life we don't know. But what we do know is that he was born in Bethsaida in Galilee. He was a fisherman. And though we're not sure of when he was born, scholars can kind of say that he died sometime between the years of 64 and 67 AD. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us this, but tradition holds that Peter was, he died by crucifixion in Rome under Emperor Nero. He was actually crucified, they say, upside down because he didn't feel worthy to be crucified in the same way that Jesus was. So though we don't know sometimes a lot about Peter from outside sources, the Bible and the Gospels are truly like a good source for his life. And it also gives us sort of a glimpse of who Peter was and what his personality was like. So Peter, in the Gospels, he's kind of outspoken. He sort of sometimes has a tendency to get ahead of himself or put his foot in his mouth. Sometimes he acts or thinks before speaking, which can kind of sometimes get him into trouble. For instance, in John 13, when Jesus goes to wash the disciples' feet, Peter gets a little bit ahead of himself and asks Jesus to wash his hands and his head as well. And at this, Jesus kind of has to slow him down a little bit. And sometimes his outspokenness leads to like outright rebuke from Jesus. There's a part in Matthew 16 and Mark 8 where Jesus is telling his disciples that he is going to die and be crucified and raised from the dead. And Peter objects. He almost says like, no, that's not going to happen to you. And this is where you probably heard this before. Jesus says, get behind me, Satan, which is it's never good for Jesus to compare you to Satan. So. But what he says is you're not setting your mind on God's purposes, but on man's. All right, but sometimes this trait, though, led to good things in Peter. Jesus asked the disciples, who do the people say I am? And they say different things. And then he asked the disciples. And Peter's the first one that speaks up. And he says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus commends Peter. And he says that came from God. And he says that you will be the rock upon which my church is built. But his boldness and his outspokenness can't be mistaken for weakness. There was this vulnerability, I think, that Peter displayed at times in the gospel. In Matthew 19 and Mark 10, the story of the rich young ruler, the ruler walks away because he cannot give up his possessions and follow Jesus. Later in that chapter, in that story, Peter talks of just the sacrifice that he and the disciples have given, that they've given up everything to follow Jesus. Because really there's like this deep, I would say love and dependence that Peter has on Jesus. In John 6, Jesus is preaching and teaching, and what he's teaching is difficult and hard to accept. And a lot of the people that are following him at the time, they leave. And when Jesus is left with the 12, he asks them if they're going to leave too. And here's Peter's answer. He says, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have words of eternal life. Because beneath all this, Peter truly has this deep love for Jesus. In John 13, when Jesus is telling the disciples that he's leaving and they can't follow him, Peter asks why he can't go with him. And also in John 18, when Jesus is arrested and Peter cuts off Malchus's ears, you get this impression that the thought of Jesus leaving and dying is truly hard for him. Now, below his boldness, sometimes there's this capacity for deep faith. And in this last story that I'm going to share, we see that This is sort of the same conflict in Peter that's going to be played out later in his denials. So in Matthew 14, Jesus has just fed the 5,000, and he sends the disciples ahead of him, and he goes alone to pray. They're out on the Sea of Galilee in the ship, and the storm comes up, and they're looking out. It's night, and they see something coming across on the water toward them. They recognize Jesus, and Peter tells Jesus, says, "Command me to walk to you." And Jesus commands him. He goes and he steps out on the water and begins to walk. Now we know that Peter begins to sink, and he doesn't walk on water, but Jesus pulls him and brings him in the boat. And here's what Jesus says to him. He says, "You have little faith. Why did you doubt?" Because there's this sort of this struggle in Peter sometimes with his faith. And it's really this struggle that he is struggling to become the person that God intends him to be. And I just ask, is that not true too? Now, Peter was a part of this inner group of the disciples. He was present for certain things that only he and James and John were present. And he's really considered to have been the leader and the spokesman of the disciples. But despite that, despite his status and his deep love for Jesus, and really despite his best intentions, he still failed that night. So let's take a minute, just talk about the events of that night and what led to Peter's denial. So the first thing, they were in the upper room. Now, in this time, Jesus was sort of preparing his disciples for his departure and for his death, and he tells them that they're going to scatter. And at this point, we see that he even, like, warns Peter of what possibly might happen. He tells him, Peter, Satan has demanded to sift you men like wheat. And if you're like me and you struggle to quite understand what that means, that was really just a metaphor that sort of meant to shake someone apart or break a person down. One commentary I read really explained it well. It means that Satan wished to shake Peter so forcefully that he would fall, proving that God's faithful servant was lacking. But then we all know Peter says he won't leave Jesus, and then that's when Jesus predicts his denial. Now then, after the upper room, Jesus and the disciples, they move to the Garden of Gethsemane. And Jesus brings aside Peter, James, and John with him and asks them to pray with him, but they're falling asleep. And here again, Jesus warns them, and he warns Peter. He says, "Peter, you should pray. You should keep watching and praying so that you do not come into temptation, because the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Now, after the Garden of Gethsemane, Judas has betrayed Jesus, and Jesus is arrested. And here is when Peter cuts off Malchus's ear, the slave. So then Jesus is taken to Annas, and Peter and another disciple follow behind. Now, in studying this, I wondered a lot about maybe what was going on through Peter's mind or what he was thinking. And I just thought of a few possible reasons why he followed Jesus. The first is maybe he wanted to prove himself, like he had said before, that he wouldn't desert Jesus. Maybe he wanted to see what was going to happen to Jesus and be there to possibly intervene like he already had if something bad were going to happen to Jesus. And I think there's also just this sense of confusion around this time of his arrest. So Jesus had warned his disciples about what was going to happen, but I don't know that they fully understood or really had thought through all the details of what he was saying. Because to be honest, the night had sort of just taken this bad turn and things were starting to unravel. And it wasn't long before that when Jesus entered Jerusalem that the people would love Jesus and they welcomed him. But now things had changed. So Peter, he might have been running on instinct, and we can't say for sure what he did, but we know that he rushed in and that he ends up failing. And what he doesn't realize is that he is ill-prepared for the situation that he's going into. Now, because of Peter's age, he was like a younger man when he followed Jesus. I think there's a great point of application for younger Christians. And I say this from experience. Sometimes when we are young, we have a tendency to think we are invincible. And we kind of rush into what we do without thinking much. We don't take advice sometimes, we don't heed warnings, and we think we don't need help. And we also sometimes have this desire to prove ourselves. And before we experience deep failure in our lives, sometimes we can look at people who fail and just say to ourselves, "That's not going to happen to me." But failure can happen, and it will. What's undecided is the nature in the degree of your failure. The question is, will you turn to Jesus in failure? If we don't, our failures will surely defeat us. And I think, and I also speak from experience in this, that the same, a lot of times, can be said for newer Christians. I'm a fairly new Christian. I was not a Christian for much of my life, and I think this has been really true for me. As a new Christian, there is sometimes also this inclination to get ahead of ourselves. We have these grand plans, and we rush into them. But the truth is, Jesus didn't need Peter to save him. That was Peter's plan, not God's. We often look too far ahead, and in the process, we lose sight of God and really the guidance of the Holy Spirit. This attitude sometimes can lead to humbling experience in life. And I think the same thing can be said when we have troubles and when we worry. We look far ahead into the future and at what we will face, and instead of walking with Jesus and step by step and in faith in our lives. Now, here's what I think this means for the older and more experienced Christians. I would say pour yourself into the lives of these younger and inexperienced Christians. In a sense, don't let them fend for themselves. And I would say be vulnerable, because they need to hear about times that you failed too. They don't need to see a perfect person. What they need to see is how the gospel transformed your life. So just to recap before we move on, we talked a little bit about who Peter was and what happened the night of his denial. But the question is, like, where exactly is he going? And where did the other Peter and the other disciple end up? Now, after Jesus' arrest, we're told he's taken to Annas, and it's most likely to his home. So if you're like me, you think of a home, you think of just a normal place. But this was most likely a large residence, almost like a palace. So just a little bit about Annas. There was just a lot of political kind of intrigue that surrounded he and his family. He had been high priest earlier before the time of Jesus' ministry. Now, the high priest, that was a religious office, but it also, under the Romans, they were sort of the political leaders of the Jewish nation. And after Annas was removed from office by the Romans, five of his sons succeeded him as high priest. And then at the time of Jesus' ministry, his son-in-law Caiaphas is actually high priest. So even though Annas wasn't the official high priest, he still had a lot of power. And because of the way he was removed from office, a lot of the Jews resented the Roman influence. And in their mind, Annas was still high priest. So one scholar put it this way, that to some extent, the power behind Caiaphas was Annas. Now, when we think about politics today, we see this corruption, and we think of how politicians are self-serving. And sadly, I think it was kind of true at that time as well. Because Annas's family, it was known for how big they were, how wealthy they were, how powerful they were, and also how greedy they were. Now, after that verse, John points out Caiaphas, and he talks about how Caiaphas was the one who had convinced the people that someone needs to die for them. And what he's talking about, just to go back a little farther, is some events in John 11. So prior to that, Lazarus has been raised from the dead, and there's this official meeting of the Sanhedrin that's called. See, the officials were a little afraid of how popular Jesus was growing to be, and their power was threatened by that. Because the truth is, if the Romans felt like they couldn't control the people, they were going to be removed from office. So here's what they decided, and here's what it had been decided in that meeting, that Jesus was going to die. Now, the only question really was not if it was going to happen, but when and how. So here's kind of like the sad truth in all this is that these people that are leading Israel at the time, they're corrupt and they're self-seeking. They have taken what their position, which was holy in God's eyes, and turned it into a means for personal gain and power. All right, now let's look at what happened actually when Peter arrives. So Peter is with another disciple. We don't know exactly who that disciple is, but the other disciple gains Peter access through the door of the courtyard because he knows the high priest. There's a slave girl that lets Peter in, and here we have Peter's first denial, because she asks, "Are you one of his disciples?" And Peter answers, "No." All right, then in verse 18, Peter joins a group of people in the courtyard, and it's a cold night, and he begins to warm himself by the fire. Now here, John, he does something interesting. He cuts to Annas' question of Jesus. And what he's doing is he's sort of creating these parallel stories. So we have the story of Jesus on trial, and we also, in some ways, have this story of Peter on trial. And we'll see that John just creates this contrast between the two because Jesus is standing true to his purpose while Peter's not. All right, so we know that while Jesus is being questioned, that he's struck. And the man who struck Jesus, he's one of like this temple guard that had arrested Jesus in the garden. So these people were also sort of had a bad connotation in that time. And they were known for their brutality. There's this song that was sung in Jerusalem at the time that mentioned them. And it said, there being the high priest and the servants, this temple guard, they would beat people with their staves. So they were sort of known for their brutality. Now in verse 24, we're then told that Jesus is sent to Caiaphas. And then we cut back to Peter. And as he's warming himself by the fire, we have to imagine some of these people around him are part of this temple police that's known for their brutality. Now, one commentator, Andreas Kosterberg, pointed out that being one of Jesus' disciples was not a legal offense, though it could have been surmised that open confession might lead to trouble, especially if Jesus is found guilty and executed. Now, it could be possible that there's this sort of growing uneasiness in Peter as he's been there. When he arrives, it's an unfamiliar place. He's around unfamiliar people, and he's really a long way from home. His accent makes him stand out. They know he's a Galilean. And in some sense, maybe the adrenaline has worn off from the night, and there's this air just surrounding that night, the whole thing, the rules really don't matter. So here in verse 25, we come to Peter's second denial. Again, as he's standing around the fire, he's asked again if he is one of Jesus' disciples, and he denies it for a second time. And then finally in verse 26 and 27, we have Peter's third denial. He's recognized by a relative of the man whose ear he cuts off. And that man says to Peter, "Did not I see you in the garden with him?" And then Peter denied Jesus for the third time and the rooster crowed. Now this is one of those stories that's in all four Gospels. And the Gospels of Luke and Matthew give us a detail that's not recorded in John. Both these Gospels tell us that after Peter denied Jesus, that he wept, and that he just didn't weep, but he wept bitterly. And when I think of that, I think of sort of this uncontrollable type of weeping, the kind that you have no power of, and there's this sort of kind of helplessness to it. We can imagine that maybe Peter is feeling regret and that he failed, and that maybe he's thinking of his pride or his arrogance. But also, I want to also question, there was some doubt in him. I can remember when I was an early Christian, I can remember the first time that I think I felt like I really failed. So before I was a Christian, I had struggled sometimes with speaking, so to speak, in anger. I would get angry and I would sort of lash out at people that I loved, and I would hurt them, you know, with my words. And when I became a Christian, I noticed that I didn't really at first do that anymore, and it was like this really wonderful thing. But I can still remember the first time that happened when I was an early Christian. And my words hurt someone I loved. And I remember at first having sort of a pride that and not being able to admit that it happened. But then when that sort of that remorse set in and that realization that happened, I remember thinking this to myself. I thought, you know, you think that you have changed and you're a different person. But you're really not. You're really no different than the person that you've always been. And there was this thing that sort of shook my faith a little bit in that. And what I think is that sometimes failure can kind of distort our thinking. And that sometimes even memories of failures can drag us back into that and also distort our thinking too. Because we have this tendency sometimes we either minimize our sin or we give it more power than what it really has. So we don't know exactly where Peter went after he denied Jesus. But we do know that we don't hear from him in the Gospels until after the resurrection. So here's what I think is really this big truth beneath all this, is that if you failed, you know that the pain of failure can change you deeply. Really the question that we have to ask is how exactly will it change us? Will it cripple us? Or will it lead to growth for us? And will that growth mean not a growth in personal strength, but a growth in relying more on Jesus and a deepening of our faith. Now, pain often leads us away from God when it really should lead us to God. Pain shouldn't produce independence necessarily and a reliance on our own strength, but pain should lead us to dependence on God and resting in his strength. Now, one of the things that I thought when I was thinking about when Jesus told Peter that he would be the rock on which he built his church, and here's kind of what I thought maybe Jesus meant in all that. It wasn't Peter's successes that made him qualified. It was his failures. Because what his failures did, it gave him a deep understanding and gratitude for the grace of God. Because the truth is, the kingdom of God isn't built on our talents or accomplishments or necessarily the abilities of Christians, but it's built on people with a deep sense of what it means to be forgiven. Because from that is born humility and a willingness to be used by God. So I want to go back to that verse in Luke 22. So Jesus says, "Peter, Peter, Satan has demanded to sift you like wheat." But here's the second part of that verse. He says, "But I have prayed for you that your faith will not fail. And you, when you have turned back, strengthen your brothers." And I think here's what Jesus is saying in that. He knows Peter's going to fail. He knows it's going to be hard. But what he's going to say is, don't forget what I've done for you. And when you remember, use that to help other people. Because Jesus wanted Peter's failure to strengthen him and be used for the glory of God. So will our failures be something that cripple us or something that God uses for his glory? Now, I'd like to speak to non-Christians. Now, if you were like me before I became a Christian, I had a lot of regret and a lot of failure in my life. So if you're feeling the pain of regret and failure, I just want to say that that might be a way that God is leading you to him. So I say, don't fight it. Now, for those of us who are Christians or even non-Christians and are stuck in failures or have been drugged back into our failures, we have to remember that Peter did something right in all of this. He wept and he grieved for his sin. When Daniel and I were going over this sermon, I think he said it best. He said it should break our hearts when we fail God. We should grieve our sins. We should make amends as best we can. And then we should rest on the work that Jesus did on the cross. And if we struggle with our failures, here's what I think is the problem with that way of thinking. What you're saying is that the sacrifice Jesus made was not enough for you. But it was maybe enough for other people, but not for you. Because there is something in us sometimes that I think makes it hard to accept God's grace. But there's no failure too great to recover from if Jesus is the source of your restoration. So James and his team, they're going to come up, and we'll have a time of reflection. Now, earlier I mentioned that John gave an account of two parallel stories when he wrote about Peter's denial. Jesus gave us this contrast that Jesus did not fail while Peter did. And I think we can kind of see that same contrast in the life of death of Jesus in our own lives. Because in a lot of ways, Jesus did stand true in his trial, but in a lot of ways we often falter and we lose faith when things get difficult. Jesus loved people and showed grace, and sometimes we don't. We'd rather not forgive and we'd rather hold on to things. Jesus lived a perfect life while we are fallible and often fall short. And I think all of this should point us to one thing, and that's the cross. Because there, though we fail, Jesus didn't. Now, here's the truth. When you believe in Jesus, when you believe that he was crucified and raised from the dead, and when you put your faith in him, Jesus changes us wholly and completely. He changes the way we view the past, so we don't look at our past as a string of failures and mistakes and see defeat. What we see is a testimony of the glory of God and the power of the gospel. So in this time of reflection, I want us all to think of just how wonderful, how profound, and just how good and life-changing God's love and forgiveness is for us.